Welcome to the Risk and Repeat podcast, episode number 2020, Peter. I'm Rob Wright, editor of Search Security, and I am here, as usual, with my site editor, Peter Loschen.
Hi, Rob.
How are you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to have you back in here. We missed you in the previous episode. I did an interview with James Plouffe of MobileIron. He's the chief solutions architect at MobileIron. They do, well, as the name would suggest, mobile device management, enterprise mobility management, etc. He's also a technical consultant on the hit show Mr. Robot, which you and I watch and love. And so that was a very interesting interview, lots of good stuff, although we have one small housekeeping note slash correction regarding that interview. James had talked about sort of the lack of technical authenticity in other TV shows, not to like throw shade at them or anything, but you know, I mean, most entertainment TV shows, movies, etc., don't always have the best track record for
getting it right.
And he had made reference to what he said was a CSI Cyber episode where two characters were sitting down at the same computer typing away on the same keyboard as fast as they can. They needed two people to stop some type of attack. Uh-huh. And actually, it was not CSI Cyber. It was NCIS. And there's a lot of, if you look this up on Google, if you Google it, there's a lot of sort of funny videos and memes and stuff like that making fun of the episode. So anyway, just wanted to mention that. Peter, it's good to have you back in here because I feel like I might get a little hot here in our Chernobyl podcast studio. We've got another round of vulnerabilities to discuss. Shadow Brokers, Project Zero, Semantic Antivirus, and I may get a little strained, may get a little hot under the collar. I need you to keep me calm. I don't know that that's going to happen, but let's dive right into it. Let's start with the latest round of Semantic Antivirus flaws. Google Project Zero, back at it again at Krispy Kreme. So yes, so
this is the third one this year, Project Zero.
Right, exactly. Living up to the core tenet of our podcast and the name of our podcast, Risk and Repeat. It's like Groundhog Day all over again. What are you going to do?
I can hear Sonny and Cher singing.
I can as well.
Which is a reference to Groundhog Day.
I love it. Yes, I love the reference. Yes.
So I called it too, didn't I, the last time?
You did. I was just going to say.
Okay, thank you.
You sat here in this studio and you said what?
This is not the last one.
Not only that, but there's probably going to be another one related to antivirus like soon.
Well, based on the bug reporting system that Google Project Zero uses, you could see there are numbers assigned to each event, each vulnerability, each task that they're working on, and you could see that there was a bunch of them that were all around the same time, but they weren't all sequential. So we had like I really wish I sat down and gotten the numbers, but I know the one that there are two that came up from this week, which were, I believe, 810 and 820.
I think that's right.
On the Project Zero tracking system. And the thing was that we had several of the ones in between there that had come up. And sure enough, this time around, what did we find? Tavis Ormady, again, from Google Project Zero, tweeting that this was the same thing that he found before in the UNRAR, in the way that the files were parsed. And his comment basically said, look, I showed you guys the last time around, this is a really old library that you're using and it's no good, you got to replace it. Well, they replaced it in the things that he noted, but this round, it's the same library in the underlying binaries that are running Symantec's code in other products, in another set of products. So it's like I predicted the future almost, but I don't think I you know, I'm not going to take credit. It's like not a big deal. It's pretty obvious.
I would take credit. I mean, I guess in retrospect it probably was, but you're right. I mean, so he points out that the UNRAR and the other products, you know, he points out those flaws, says it needs to be updated. They update those products, but they don't do it in any of the others. And he seems pretty perturbed, and probably rightfully so. So in his bug report, he says, quote, I had expected Symantec to rebase on 5.4.2, the latest version as of this writing, but they appear to have just backported fixes for the few issues that I sent them. Look, Symantec they're having trouble with this, obviously. This is a bad look. I can forgive them for a couple of errors here or there, some outdated libraries that, you know, no one's updated, no one's patched, etc. But it seems like there's one thing after another with this company and with this product line and with this antivirus engine. And you I don't know, like, do they even care about their reputation at this point? I mean,
I was trying to Google a little bit to see if I could find the actual article, but there was came up in the last day or so an article that basically said the difference between the cost of an actual intrusion or a breach is less than the cost of putting all the protection that you need to avoid that breach.
Oh, is that true?
Well, I think it was an opinion piece, but they did have some numbers, and they said that they apparently a new survey, which we love, came out saying that the actual cost of a breach on average is about $200,000 instead of I don't know, whatever, however many millions it was the last report that we saw. And the person who brought that up raised the issue of Ford's position on the Pinto, which I don't.
Oh yeah.
Okay, I remember when this happened.
Oh yeah.
If you're driving in a Pinto and you got rear-ended, a Ford Pinto was kind of like it was a compact car, and if you got hit in the rear, it would crumple the gas tank and go on fire.
Yeah.
And Ford knew that. They knew there was a flaw in the manufacturing, and their lawyers decided that it would be better to just take the cost of the lawsuits on the estimated, I don't know, 180 or so deaths that they forecast would be due to that flaw, because that would be cheaper than spending the money to recall all the Pintos and fixing them. I mean, and it's, you know, Chevrolet had the Corvair. And
right.
The Volkswagen has the TDI diesel, which I'm still dealing with that.
But,
you know, there's all these cases where the cost of doing it the right way is so much more than the actual cost of not doing it and just paying the fine. It's sort of like this has happened to me. I've been I think it happened in Boston. I got a ticket for parking, and the fine for the ticket was $15. If I'd have gone to a garage, which I should have done, it would have cost me $25. So what are you going to do if you park illegally and you get a $15 ticket, or you park legally and you pay $25? Which is better?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a good point. I mean, but it makes me angry now because, I mean, what did Symantec just spend on acquiring Blue Coat? $4 billion plus? They don't have the money to sit down and say, we're going to hire... Like, not just new developers to write better code, but we're going to hire bug hunters, or we're going to do a bug bounty, or we're going to do something to make sure that we don't keep getting our bell rung by Google Project Zero.
Well,
I mean, they've got, but it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't feel like the company is compelled to actually do that. And the reason that's more upsetting than, say, if it was Oracle or Apple, is that Symantec is in the security business. And if they can't even update their outdated, you know, open source software or their software libraries that they know that there's vulnerabilities lurking in them, and they can't be compelled to actually clean it up, at least take a look, do something.
I hear you, Rob.
It's pretty upsetting, but you know that's not the most. That's not the only upsetting vulnerability that we're dealing with, I guess, this week. Correct, Peter?
Yeah.
We're also looking at another shadow brokers back in the news.
Another egregious blunder.
Oh, man.
Was that one of the tools that was released, Egregious Blunder?
Oh, that's a great name. If not, it should have been. Can we petition to have that be a name of a vulnerability?
Or a band name. That's the other option.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's... What was the name on that subject? What was the name of the Cisco firewall exploit? It was...
This week?
Yeah.
Well, last time it was... The first time around, it was something about bacon. But this time it was Benign Certain.
Oh. Ah, yeah, okay. I see it. Benign Certain.
Yes. So...
And so... You also wrote that story. Tell us a little bit about what you found there.
Well, you know, again, the problem is, how much do you have to fix? Do you have to fix all the stuff that was broken in lines that are no longer active, like the PIX product line from Cisco?
Right.
That was one of the places where, if I remember correctly, because that was what? That was like 3 days ago that I wrote that.
Yeah. The world's moved on.
The world has, yeah, and as have I, but
yeah.
So Benign Certain affected Cisco's legacy PIX firewall.
Right.
Fine. Okay, so that's been legacy for almost 8 or 10 years, 8 or 9,
a while. I mean, a lot of people still use them.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of people still do use them. But the issue was not so much PIX as the actual flaw was also found in more modern Cisco's line. So CVE 2016-6415 is the CVE number that they gave it, and it affects all versions of Cisco iOS XE, iOS XR, software releases prior to 5.3.x and many versions of Cisco iOS, but only for systems configured to use Internet Key Exchange Protocol, version 1.
Right.
So, okay, this brings in, you know, like, this is great because it's three different ways about. One is the Benign Certain was not the actual vulnerability. It was related. It was similar. So it was a new one, but it was the same thing. And it had to do with an old version of a protocol. We're all up to IKE version 2, but this was with Internet Key Exchange Protocol version 1. So another one of these things where backward compatibility, you know, everybody loves backward compatibility, but the problem with it is that it's backward compatible for your attackers too. I mean... And at the same time, if you've gone years between using Microsoft Word like I have,
you've discovered
that files that you used to be able to open in one version in an old version
now it's
garbled.
Yeah.
So we don't always get backward compatibility when we want it. When we don't want it, or when the attackers want it, is when we don't want it, and that's when it's bad. So we've seen that with some of the SSH stuff.
Sure.
A lot of the big ones, I'm not going to say any names because then you'll have to run a correction next week. But all these things where you throttle stuff for TLS or SSL, SSH, when you have the option to go back to an MD, let's say an old algorithm that's no longer considered secure. If you allow that option, or if you allowed it at some time and you didn't pull it out of your code base entirely, somebody's going to find a way to get back to that or force that to take precedence. So, you know, that's shadow brokers, and I don't think that's the last one of these that we're going
to
see.
Oh, either. No, definitely. And to your point about the backward compatibility, I mean, we're going to talk about this in a minute. the historic and unprecedented DDoS attack on Brian Krebs on his Krebs on Security website. I was reading about it on Twitter, and someone said, "Well, why don't you just move the site to, you know, exclusively IPv6 connectivity?" And someone replied and said, "Well, then you'd be DDoSing yourself because not enough people have that yet to." I mean, it's an idea, but his point is right. It's like either you allow, you know, connectivity across IPv4, or you don't. But then you cut your audience by what, 3/4, 2/3 at least.
Well, yeah, but it's dropping.
Totally. I mean, IPv6 is definitely, adoption is going up, but it's the same thing as like if you move to a more recent protocol for whatever, TLS or what, name one, but you don't allow support for the previous existing one, which has been shown to be vulnerable, then you're limiting access. You know, you're closing people off that haven't updated. And there's too many places that are not, too many companies, too many developers, too many, you know, systems that are not willing to do that. So, you know, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I do, I mean, to the earlier point about semantic, I guess I do sympathize a little with companies that are in this position, because you can run into situations like what you just had with the Windows anniversary update. You know, Windows 10 anniversary update. They didn't do compatibility checks. And boom, you know, older versions of McAfee and other antivirus programs are just, you know, they get blown up because of the new OS. So anyway, but yeah, so, you know, getting back to Benign Certain, I mean, this is another example of something. Correct me if I'm wrong, Peter. You wrote the story and you're knowledgeable about things, all things networking. But this is another thing that it was like. This has probably been around a number of years. No one knew about it? I mean, obviously the NSA and the Equation Group knew about it. They have the hacking tool to exploit it. Mm-hmm. But no one within Cisco or anywhere, no security researchers, no. And this was already, remember, this was already being exploited. And they're not totally sure if it was just being exploited because the shadow brokers released it or if it was really being exploited. I mean, that's the question, right?
Well, as far as Benign Certain and the flaw that Cisco patched related to it, that the part of the reason they did that was that they were detecting actual attacks using Well, yeah, we don't know that the actual Benign Certain is in use, but you bring up shadow brokers again, and you reminded me that. Not that just this morning, was it this morning?
Yesterday.
Yesterday, late yesterday.
We're recording this on a Friday, the 23rd.
So we've got the end of the week.
For posterity's sake, yeah.
End of the week brain burn, but but Reuters reported five anonymous sources on this story.
Five independent sources. Four or five, but yeah.
It was four that were related to the investigation.
Yep.
And a fifth that it was also anonymous.
Yep.
That believe that this happened in 2014, I think.
Yeah.
And that they think it was an operative, an NSA person, who left the tools, which I think was one of the speculations that we had.
Right, yeah.
We reported earlier.
There was an op somewhere, and they put this stuff on a staging server, and someone left the barn door open.
Right.
They didn't remove it. They didn't wipe it. I think Snowden might have said that too.
Yeah, there were. I mean, that was one of the conjectures.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it seems as likely as anything. Although I wonder if there's some sort of self-serving motive in there to say, well, look, we didn't get hacked. It was just some idiot who left this stuff, you know, lying on someone's server somewhere, and they forgot to take it down, which, you know, maybe a little damage control for the NSA to say, hey, look, we weren't breached, we weren't hacked, et cetera, et cetera. So who knows? I mean, that could be what's going on. But yeah, I think you're right about, you know, we haven't seen the last of vulnerabilities like this popping up and stuff being disclosed from the shadow broker's dump of exploits and, you know, cyber weapons or whatever you want to call them. So
well, so I just pulled up the Reuters story.
Yeah.
The thing I wanted to comment about this particular story is they knew it happened at the time in 2014, but they monitored all their sensors and they, you know, to see if anybody was actually using the exploits. And and their logic was, well, nobody's using them, so we don't have to report them to anybody.
That's remarkable.
And like I say this, what, like two or three times a month? It's not the sin, it's the cover up.
Yeah.
It's not the crime or the mistake that was made, it's the cover up.
Right.
They're gonna get more heat for the cover up than they would have gotten just for the event happening.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's now public. Although the Yahoo breach is kinda over.
That's next week's podcast.
Yeah, that's next week's.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot to unpack with that one.
Right. No, I think.
But yeah, that brings up a bunch of questions about. Well, yeah, you know where I'm going with that. But so for Benign Certain, if you recall, at the beginning of the week we had a bit of a discussion about whether or not this was actually patched. It's as far as we know. There's been no actual patch for this exploit. There's a workaround that Cisco announced in its security advisory about it, but there's no, as far as I know, right?
So, yeah, there's no workaround yet. There's no patch yet. The only thing I guess you can do is, follow the advice that Cisco gives in their advisory.
Right.
But one of the key things here is that it only affects systems that are running IKEv1 and here's the note. Although only IKEv1 packets can be used to trigger this vulnerability, devices running Cisco IOS software or Cisco IOS XE software are vulnerable when they are configured to use IKEv1 or IKEv2.
Right.
So,
well, that's great news.
Well, they've got an ongoing investigation to see if other Cisco products are affected, and they'll let us know if additional products are found to be vulnerable.
What do you think the answer is going to be there?
Yes. I wouldn't.
Put your prediction hat on. You did pretty well with the
other one. Yeah. I think there's a good shot that there'll be another Shadow Brokers vulnerability that's a live vulnerability that we haven't heard about.
Right.
I'm not sure that it's going to be this particular one, but I think Cisco has not seen the end of it.
Yeah, and if you're a hacker and you are somewhat familiar with the specifics of this exploit and Cisco product lines past and present, what are you doing right now? You're sitting down and you're saying, oh, well, they did X, they made this, they include support for this thing that they knew was problematic. Let's poke around and see what else they left lying out.
Which raises another issue for me, and I'm not technical enough to know the answer, but if you saw a description of some of these vulnerabilities that were revealed by Shadow Brokers, and you sit down and you figure out what the flaw actually was, and you rewrote another tool for another piece of hardware, you know, you're not using the Shadow Broker tool. You're using a tool that you've adapted from Shadow Brokers. My question is, will the NSA's monitors pick that up, or will that look like an entirely different exploit?
That's a great question that we'll never get the answer to, because
unless
NSA
we,
will never.
Well, we can ask somebody who's smart.
Yeah, that's true.
Or than
that
us.
Would be interesting. I mean, yeah, I guess I suppose if it included a specific signature, it would, and if it didn't, it wouldn't. But yeah, We should probably look into that. I mean, to bring these two vulnerabilities though together, I mean, let me put you on the spot, Peter. What is an enterprise to do with this news? Like, let's say you use Symantec and you use, you know, Cisco products that are affected, and you get this news that there are vulnerabilities like this, and in the case of Cisco, there is no patch yet. It's not feasible for you to sit there and say, well, I'm going to take these firewalls offline, or I'm going to take the software, you know, running the guts of my network offline. So, like, what do you do? What are you left with? What recourse does an organization have in a situation like this?
I can tell you what Cisco suggests, and that is they say determine if IKE ports are open on a running device,
mm-hmm.
and they give, you know, fairly simple command line commands to figure that out. Determine if IKE features are included in the device configuration to see if the iOS device, the Cisco iOS device configuration is vulnerable. So you got to see if there's if it is configured to use IKE, and then check the version numbers that you're running. They give instructions for that.
Sure.
And I think basically the bottom line is they said there's no workarounds, but implement an intrusion prevention system or intrusion detection system.
I love that.
Yeah.
That are probably signature-based and aren't going to pick up an attack that hasn't been recorded yet anyway.
Right. And then administrators are advised to monitor affected systems. Well, that's fantastic. It's good advice.
I know,
but it should go without saying.
I guess big picture, yes, mm-hmm. there are steps you can use. I mean, we do ATEs, ask the experts with our core of expert contributors. We do them every week. And a lot of the advice comes back to, do X, Y, and Z. Make sure you have your, updated virus definitions. Make sure you have your intrusion detection or intrusion prevention system up and running and updated. Make sure it's not relying solely on signature-based detection, et cetera, et cetera. So we go through this every week. But I guess big picture, We were just talking about it. We think that there's going to be more vulnerabilities. We think there's going to be more Symantec. We think there's going to be more Shadow Broker vulnerabilities that probably affect Cisco and other networking gear. Like, big picture, this puts enterprises in a horrible position, because now you know that something is probably coming. I don't know that an organization can sit there and say, we're going to rip this stuff up and move to, because, I mean,
who
are you going to move to? But not only that, but that's hard. That's expensive. I mean, the way IT budgets work is, you allocate a certain level of spending for each sort of component of your IT environment, and you don't want to go over that, like, for any reason. Even in cases where you know something is vulnerable and it's going to potentially be affected by a new threat. And, I don't know what recourse. I mean, short of sort of, devoting entire portions of your InfoSec team to bug hunting or something of that nature. Like, I don't know what you do.
It's a good question. The only if you're asking me.
Yes.
It sounds like you are.
Move to mainframes.
Well, no. It seems as though the only solution is to just have a very multidimensional security stance where you're looking. You're not just looking at the firewall to keep you safe. You're looking at the firewall. If you're going to go to intrusion detection or prevention, do those, but also do data loss prevention if that's something that still makes sense for your organization.
Assume you have an intruder on the network already and start encrypting everything. Look for data exfiltration.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, the stance has to be that you assume that you're already you've already been breached.
Yeah.
Rather than assume that everybody's, a nice scout and they're going to follow the rules like they did, back in 1988.
Sure.
You could do that.
Yeah.
But in 2016, it's harder to do that. You can't really get up and say, okay, well, I'm going to allow anything that's not specifically forbidden is allowed. Now we have to go to everything that's not specifically allowed is forbidden.
Yep.
And well, that's gonna change things. But by having different dimensions that you're working on, you can, you know, you're never going to close up all the holes.
Yeah, true.
But you can make them small and reduce the number.
So before I guess we wrap up this edition of Risk and Repeat, we did want to I do want to go over quickly the you know, the aforementioned DDoS attack on Brian Krebs on his website. Now, how big was this, Peter? It was
665 gigabytes.
Yeah, per second.
Wow.
So pretty massive, and it looks like Akamai and its DDoS anti-DDoS outfit division group Prolexic said that it was almost twice the size of any attacks they had ever seen before, which that's pretty big. And it was so bad that the other day Akamai said, they basically said uncle, they said no mas, sorry Brian, we've got to take you off our network because it's impacting service for other customers. And which we should know, Krebs was totally okay with. He said on Twitter that, hey, this is a pro bono service that Akamai offers to me. It's the right call from them, you know, which, you know, good for him. But it's interesting to see this attack because, you know, a lot of people have chimed in on about this on Twitter. A few individuals and specifically have talked about the nature of this attack. Like, so Nicholas Weaver of the International Computer Science Institute in Berkeley, California, talked about how, you know, hey, there's been big DDoS attacks. You know, he said specifically, I'll read you the tweet, that someone can produce a 600 gigabyte per second denial of service attack isn't surprising. That someone can produce a non-amplified denial of service attack is. This has some huge implications. And he's right. So, I mean, I looked at this and I said, I made a comparison on Twitter and I said, I don't know why I get, like, I know hackers are perturbed with Brian Krebs and they're always trying to mess with this site. But it seemed to me using like this level of attack, something this powerful just to knock his website out was really odd. Like, why? And I likened it to basically using the Death Star to blow up the Millennium Falcon instead of Alderaan. I mean, really, it's kind of overkill. Like, when, like if you were going to use something like a sort of a historic and a DDoS attack of unprecedented power, I would think that you would go for something that, you know, a government agency, government website, a cloud provider, a major enterprise, knock them down, do some Mr. Robot type stuff, and do it in a way that was that, you know, there was a window, like. Like something was being broadcast or something was, you know, limited time and you knew your DDoS attack, if it lasted several days, would really mess with the... But Krebs, I mean, he's going to be back up somewhere. His stories aren't going anywhere. It just seems odd.
Well, the first thing I thought when you started talking just now about, like, what's going on, what was the... You know, it's easy. My first response was, well, he just
ticked off called some hackers.
Yeah, he ticked off some hackers who do massive DDoSs. But my second first thought is, should have been the first one, is, didn't we just talk about Bruce Schneier coming out last week
and talking about? I am so glad you mentioned that. Continue, Peter.
Because this is exactly what Bruce Schneier seemed to be talking about.
Yeah.
These massive and unrelenting attacks that are probing. You know, they may
looking for ways to take down the internet. Like, literally take down the internet.
Right. And Krebs, granted, he's not Google or Microsoft.
No.
But he is a researcher, a security guy, and he knows security and he's got resources. And if you're gonna put up a DDoS against somebody like that and they can't deal with it, that says something to me. That says that you've gone beyond the ordinary DDoS.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess when I made that comparison on Twitter, and I should say that Krebs responded and said, you know, perhaps you're, you know, my analogy about the Death Star and Millennium Falcon and Alderaan. He said, but remember, there are millions of devices that can, and they can enlist at any time. Maybe it's more like armies of stormtroopers and not the Death Star. And he's, so that's what worries me. So looking at this situation now, that's what worries me. It's not just that they, you know, yes, they targeted Krebs, and I'm sitting here saying, well, why didn't you do something bigger? But maybe they can do something bigger. And maybe this is just a statement to say, look, we did this. It's not an amplification attack. It's not a DNS attack. This is a straight DDoS. We're using potentially millions of devices that you don't know where they are. And I said, well, why would you do it now? You're tipping your hand. Now Akamai, Prolexic, others, they know that this is coming. They're going to be looking for it, and they're going to look for ways to prepare. But the other side of that is maybe the people behind this just don't care. And this is just a taste of what they can do, going back to Schneier.
Well, exactly.
That's what worries me.
If Akamai threw their hands up after 2 days,
Uncle,
and said, Uncle, yeah, exactly. Akamai is full of a lot of brainy people. They're, you know, they've been doing this for a long time.
Right.
And if they can't handle it, what's going to happen when somebody else who doesn't have the resources of an Akamai gets hit with something like this?
That's a great question.
Or 20 organizations or websites get hit, or 100, or the top 100,
yeah,
top 500 websites on the,
yeah,
on
exactly,
the internet. You know, we don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah. What do you think we're gonna do after I hit stop on this recording? We're gonna talk to our CIO, see what kind of DDoS protection we have. I mean, I'm not joking. Anyway, we should probably. We're gonna keep an eye on this, because this has got big implications. But we should probably leave it there before we really descend into conspiracy theories. And Peter, as always, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast.
Always happy to be here.
And you may not have kept me calm, cool, and collected as usual, but it was good to have you back. Good to talk about the latest vulnerabilities and threats and implications of historic DDoS attacks. And as usual, I'm Rob Wright with Search Security. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Risk and Repeat podcast, and we will see you next time.